Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the psychedelic trip to my psychotic drip, it's Dan.
Good morning again, Scott, and how are you doing on this fine day?
I am somewhat bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, as much as I'm going to be on a day like today, but I've been up raring to do this podcast, as well as monitoring my Facebook feed all day, pretty much.
Yeah. Last night, within a few minutes of watching the episode, I'm like, this is going to be a fun one to podcast about. Meaning, more fun than it isn't in the first place. But also, happy birthday. How old are you today now? 39, I believe?
I believe I'm going to do the old-fashioned Jack Benny thing, and I'll be 39 forever at this point. Fortunately, right now, I can still get away with looking at least 39. Some people say even 38 sometimes. But nice. Yes, today is going to be an odd birthday for me because I believe I'm bookending my day, morning and night, with recording two podcasts. Which is kind of funny when people have been asking me, hey, what are you doing on your birthday? It's like, apparently I'm recording two podcasts. That's where life has gotten me today. But, when we're talking about a show like the one we're here to talk about, Legion, it doesn't feel that bad. So, we are here to talk about the penultimate episode of the I Can't Believe It's Almost Over Already season one of Legion. But before we wade into those waters, let's swim back to our previous chapter. Because again, I still have just a few more thoughts on last week's episode. Now, to be honest here, I've actually edited several of these out because I felt they were pretty much addressed and answered in Chapter 7, which tells you just what a completely perfect episode Chapter 7 was, but we're not there yet. Let's get back to Chapter 6. Thing I think I failed to make mention of last week, that little exchange between Tanami and David about how everybody loves dogs and David says, not me. Beyond the fact that Tanami, looks a little taken aback in that moment, hey, David's the one who had the imaginary dog King, who also turns out to be part of that shifting parasite that had been with him since birth. So, it was, when I first heard the line, I was like, well, that doesn't make sense, because you imagine yourself having a dog your entire childhood. But then when you think about what that dog actually represented, maybe that line made a heck of a lot more sense than I realized.
Oh, yeah.
So that was kind of a... And I love how something just so minor, and which almost seemed like a throwaway conversation, actually had a lot more going on with it, I thought. Now, this is something that happens from time to time with our podcast, where I'll be talking about the show with someone, days later, and a conversation that we have inspires me to bring it up on the podcast. And this came up a few days ago. I was talking with... close friend of mine who's also a listener, and we were talking about David's sister, Amy, and how cruel she was to David, and the person we were speculating as to why was she being depicted in such a, for lack of a better way to put it, such a villainous way. And I hadn't really thought about it too much last week, but the more I thought about it, and, tell me if you agree with me or not to whatever extent, if David himself, I shouldn't even say if, David himself is responsible for creating, generally speaking, that entire Clockwork's reality. That really becomes more clear in Chapter 7, quite frankly. But saying he created that, so I feel that either subconsciously or not, David also kind of created the way Amy is in that reality. And because David had found out, when he was in like phantom mode, that she actually knew about what had happened to him, that he had powers, that he actually wasn't mentally ill, and so on. So in a way, his growing lack of trust or loss of faith in his own sister maybe is what leads him to have her depicted in such a villainous way, where she's out and out saying that you're not lovable, you know, your friends don't like you, whatever. I think that cruelty kind of goes with the way that maybe in the moment how he was seeing the way her in a new light, a darker light, perhaps. Does that make any sense? Do you think that might be something there?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. I'm wondering if maybe the Shadow King's responsible for that depiction of her, and maybe she, like, you know, was decent and solid and supportive of him, and she just didn't like that. Like, she doesn't like, doesn't like Sid. Maybe it's something like that, too.
I think that's just as good an explanation, because you can say, is the Shadow King controlling this version of Amy? Making Amy one of its, I don't know what the word is, tools, so to speak.
Yeah, like the eye is.
Right. Oh boy, I can hardly wait to talk about chapter 7. I know, gotta stick with chapter 6 first. Okay. I want to address something you brought up in the last podcast, because I wasn't sure, and I think I might have even been wrong, because unlike certain people that we know, or certain people in politics, I will admit I'm wrong. During Lenny's I'm Feeling Good dance sequence, since I did rewatch it, I wanted to confirm that she does not ever go back to David's childhood bedroom. Because she, you know, recalled she was walking through basically his memories, kind of, you know, and screwing around. That's the one area she doesn't show up in. And I thought she had. I think you asked me about that. And I think I assumed that she had. I went back and watched it. She does not walk through that room the way she does. I mean, she walks through the room like the kitchen or the room where he was having sex with Philly that time, and or the other different places in Summerland. But she does not walk through the childhood bedroom, which I think is actually pretty significant because of other things that happened in the episode, which I'm going to get to pretty soon, actually. But I just wanted to let you know, you were wondering about that, which means you were onto something once again. So, see, that's what happens when you speak up.
It's good. It's good to be onto something instead of on something like I was the week before.
Oh well, yeah. we won't talk about that. Now, Sid, her first dream—I guess we can call it a dream of memories. I did notice something because we've talked about the countless touches. Nods to cinema in this TV show. Obviously, a lot of it's David Lynch, and you got your Stanley Kubrick stuff too. It felt like you've got a couple really quick nods to The Shining here. There's that one where there's that nice point of view where they're gliding through the corridors, which is so reminiscent of the kid on the big wheel in The Shining. So it's shot in a very similar fashion, only without the big wheel sound, of course. But also, and this is almost, it's not subliminal, but it almost might affect a person in the same way, the way a subliminal thing can. There's that music or sound effect that they use when we see the Shadow King, which is really reminiscent of some of the more shocking quick reveals towards the end of The Shining. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where it's that weird percussive, you know, frightful sound. They use it for the Shadow King.
And yeah.
When Shelley Duvall's running around the hotel and seeing all the freaky stuff, it's if it's not the exact same sound, it's really close to it. I'm thinking it's got to be their way of kind of referencing that. I mean, they're referencing a lot of movies throughout the show that, you know, and they're doing it in a more subtle way than I think we're used to sometimes. So it's not like overt, but I think that was one of the more obvious ones to me, at least. Going back to what I was just saying about David's childhood bedroom, something I was actually confused by, because when Sid has put on the headphones with the crickets playing, initially
she's probably just listening to our podcast since we have to insert crickets often enough.
Right. Now I feel bad. But I thought, oh, she's floating back to her own room. And then I thought it was really interesting that when she's gotten there, that the light that's being cast on her is clearly the light from David's old constellation lamp. But and I thought, and so I initially thought, oh, they're kind of foreshadowing where she's going to end up later. But then it occurred to me, since that's where we see her with the headphones on, that's where she floated to from the get-go. So is that what happens? Is that where she actually ends up in the first place? She ends up back in David's childhood room and not in her own room at all?
That's the impression that I got. And then they kind of confirm that this next episode.
Yeah. This is one of those things that when I wrote the original note, and then as I watched it, I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of answered the question. But I figured this one I left in. There were other things which I was talking. I had this whole bunch of notes about the therapy sessions and how if this is really David's other side, then he, of course, would know their weaknesses and whatever. And we're like, yeah, this is more of the parasite at work here. I'm not going to talk about that. Weird line here. Maybe they're just being cute, or maybe there's so much stuff going on with eyes on this TV series. You know, between a character who's known as the Eye and the fact that Lenny's or the Shadow King's eyes keep appearing everywhere in this really weird state. A little bit in that episode and certainly a lot in Chapter 7. Do you notice that the Eye, when he's being all creepy to Carrie, he says, the line he says is like, the wolf says, what big eyes you have. Whereas, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm pretty sure this time I'm not, it's not the wolf who says that in Little Red Riding Hood. That's said about the wolf. Well, what big eyes you have, what big teeth you have, whatever. So it's kind of funny that he reversed it here when clearly in their little scenario, like he's the wolf and she's like Little Red Riding Hood or whatever. A Little Red Jogging Suit, I guess. Now, that reappearing door that Sid sees and then disappears and David sees later, she even refers to it looking like more like an old wooden bedroom door. Should we therefore assume, is it safe to say that that's supposed to be the door to his childhood bedroom? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's the impression that I've been getting.
Yeah, there seems to be something about that room. It's sort of, I don't know if it's a staging ground or I can't really say it's a safe place because we've certainly seen bad things happen in there. So it's, but it's interesting that it seems to be the nexus of a lot of things here. There's something that happened in this episode that I don't know why I didn't notice it the first time. I feel horrible that I missed a detail that was like right in front of me. I don't know what happened. Maybe I blinked. There's a moment where Melanie, she's, you know, remember she's doing that all that weird stuff where she's watering like little flowers and stuff. But she's watering a tiny grave. It's like a little tombstone with flowers that are growing out of it, whatever. But I was like, wait, what? Why is she watering a small grave? What the hell is that all about? Although we see something which is grave-related in the next chapter, so maybe it's referencing that, I don't know. But that's a really strange little image there, which I can't believe I didn't notice the first time around. And also, during that moment, that guy in the bushes is there again. from Chapter 1. The guy was like camouflaged in the bushes with no explanation whatsoever. Sticking with Melanie, it is interesting that when she goes back to that room with the gunfire, the fact that she's already in that room, but at least in Chapter 6... she never seems to take any notice of her own double or be even cognizant of that. So it was just a strange thing because you'd think if you walked into a room where all the stuff, and granted, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in that room, but I would think the first thing that would make you go, huh, is seeing yourself in that room. So it's just interesting that she like doesn't even notice herself in that room. Actually, I only have one more thing. Then we can get to the episode. I don't know if I mentioned, either of us mentioned, that whole story that Lenny tells David at the end about love being like, you know, that jungle fungus, you know, for ants. It's just a straight up, on the nose analogy for her parasitic attachment to David and how it will eventually blow his head up as well. I mean, she even refers to herself as his own walking, talking fungus. So she confirms it herself. Forget theory. It's pretty much what their relationship is. I don't think I mentioned it when we talked about it last week. And that would be where the crickets are. Anyway, so you know what? let's stop talking about Chapter 6. I think we've covered it enough. We certainly covered it last week a ton. Let's move on to the penultimate episode of the season. And boy, was it a doozy. Let's start talking about Legion Chapter 7. Now, with Chapter 7, when we open on it, we see that it's not just the eye that's stalking Carrie Loudermilk. It's also those big luminous or even somewhat lecherous eyes of Lenny seem to be pursuing her through what's now seemed to have become, it looks like this nightmarish dreamscape of what was originally just the hallways and corridors of the Clockworks facility. But it's we realize there's something else the Shadow King, and I love that we got confirmation on it being the Shadow King, by the way, is seeking here. Because as we see it phasing back and forth between its creepy blobby form to Lenny, it keeps repeating, what did he do with it? And then we see Amy. Poor Amy. Once again, she's on the frightened receiving end of yet another interrogation on this series. I think that's basically her function half the time on this show. And it forces her to recount the day, I guess, that David was first brought to her home as a baby. Although they don't really do too much with that little backstory there. Meanwhile, we see that Carrie is in Oliver's ice cube. And while it's sad that Oliver clearly doesn't remember his wife, Melanie, both he and Carrie have figured out just what that parasite is that's attached itself to David, which actually rendered many theories, mine included, kind of moot. So just to put it straight out there, they agree that this thing, it's a separate consciousness from David that attached itself to him through his mind and has been using David's power to feed his own. But Oliver knows what or who it is. He names it. It's Amal Farouk, who is otherwise known as the Shadow King. So, hats off, you said it a few weeks ago, and that's what we've been sort of calling it for the last few weeks. That's now we now have absolute confirmation that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, that was kind of cool, and I definitely wasn't expecting them to come out and like say anything like that. I mean, the show tends to be pretty vague, so whenever they're giving us any information, it's just like, what?
Yeah, this would be, in fact, I would even go as far as say, this is the episode where vagueness takes a powder, and they probably pack more exposition into this episode than any other that I can recall, but it's probably handled better than exposition ever tends to be in even the better TV shows or movies.
Right.
You know, because it's done either in an entertaining way, or it's done in a way where you're not even realizing that's what's happening. Which is the key to good exposition, just in general, is you get away with an information dump, but you keep the viewer or reader, if you're reading something, engaged. You find it compelling. Whether it's a great story being told or it's being done in some sort of visually interesting way or whatever. And obviously this is a show that really handles both those kind of things very well so far.
Yeah. And the way that it's the information's being conveyed to us here, I mean, just sitting here listening to you talk about it now, I've got the thought that maybe, you know, that there's probably something significant about the fact that Oliver can remember his enemy, assuming that's his enemy, Farouk, but he can't remember Melanie. That might be something that, you know, has something to do with Oliver. Or if, you know, if it is them giving away David for adoption at some point in the future, I mean, you know, just stuff like that. That's the way that they give exposition in certain ways might be significant after the fact.
Yeah, there is something to be said for the fact he obviously remembers a villainous character from his life pre-Ice Cube, but he can't remember his wife. That has to be significant. I'm not so sure about the parentage theory, but we're going to get to that a little bit later. I think we could get to that more in our general discussion afterwards.
Yeah.
Because I kind of think that might be a theory they might have put to bed here, but we'll get there shortly. I think you know what I'm talking about anyway, but you know,
yeah,
probably a good portion of our listeners know what I'm talking about on that one. At least people who are into the comic books. But again, and going back to Oliver and Carrie, and by the way, I love the combination of these two characters and actors, and Bill Irwin is, you know, doing fine work on this series. To give him, Even his eye being all screwed up is really kind of awesome. Oh, by the way, another weird eye thing. Just realized that. Yet another weird eye thing on the show. But they work out how they're going to be able to rescue David and the others while preventing them all from being gunned down. Once time and reality resumes, because we can't forget that those bullets, they're maybe in super slow-mo, but eventually they're going to find their targets if someone doesn't do something about it. So, but what's great is that they bring up, or Carrie brings up, that Halo device that he created back in, I guess it was Chapter 5. So thankfully they're actually going to do something with that, as opposed to just being some invention he came up with and then got largely forgotten here. So then we kind of pick up back where we left off at the end of the previous chapter, when Carrie wakes up Sid when he's wearing the diving suit and everything. And what I was just saying about exposition, what they do here is, I hate the fact that I fall into hyperbole when I talk about this show, but I don't care because it's one of the few shows I've ever seen that I think deserves it. So if I start using words like brilliant and awesome or whatever, I think the show has earned it. This, to me, not only being really funny, I would say this is a brilliant use of how to get away with exposition. That Carrie takes Sid into what's essentially what looks like a gigantic, like, what do you call that? Like a pneumatic tube. You know, the kind of things they used to use back in the day to send messages, you know, in giant office buildings, right, or a post office, yeah, or something. Now, the way that little moment is, that's not really little, the way the moment is initially set up, it's going to be, oh, Carrie's going to tell Sid everything that's going on, some of which we may already know already, and maybe we'll learn something new here. But they don't do that. They have Sid beating Carrie to the punch with almost every piece of information, because Sid's not stupid. Sid's smart. She has been because she's been the one who's been onto things all along. She was the one who was onto things not being real in the whole clockwork scenario. She has figured stuff out. So what they actually accomplish here is a scene that was going to be about exposition and giving a story actually gives us character. It tells us more about Sid as a character. The fact that she is really a driving force in this story, and how keen she is up to things, how perceptive. She's very perceptive. And it's done so well. I mean, I've made no secret effect of you know, we on our other podcast, I know you've had occasional what we call fantasy crushes on characters on different shows over the last couple of years. Last time I probably did that was maybe during our Mad Men days, maybe, like, you know, the Peggy days or something like that. I can't tell you how big a crush I have on Sid. I just think she's the most amazing, awesome character ever. I mean, I probably love her character even if she was a dude, whatever, but the fact that she's not makes it that much more exciting for me, because I just love her so much. But what's really then makes the scene just kind of get just loopy, but lovely at the same time, is not just the fact that they come to a decision about how they're going to deal with things, that Sid is going to help, distract the monster while rounding up the others, while Carrie, I guess with Oliver, is going to try to do something about those bullets that are slowly heading towards Sid and David. But it's the thing that he gives her, the several pairs of glasses that Oliver has developed that will help them see what's actually real and what's not in that Clockwork's alternate reality. I'm trying to figure out, because if Oliver made these glasses, he's a guy who's almost literally frozen in the early 1970s. How the heck did he see the 1980s film They Live? Because this is totally They Live. but I just love that idea. Like, oh, here's, and again, it's giving them glasses to see things.
Yeah,
it's there's a thematic motif going on here throughout the show about eyes, once again, about seeing things, what's real, and all that. This is the kind of thing that, if this is all in a movie, this would be one of those film class 101 things. You could see kids writing up the most boring papers ever just about eyes and shit. And I'd probably be one of those kids. There you go. So back to that mostly frozen gunfire scene where we left Melanie in the previous chapter. when Carrie and Oliver appear there, kind of going back to what we were talking about moments ago, it's kind of this weird mix of something that's both comic and tragic, which is something this show tends to do, especially with the Oliver character, I've noticed. Because he, on one hand, he's really funny, but it's really sad that he doesn't seem to know who Melanie is. So, and you got to give Jean Smart a lot of credit, because she's not... She doesn't have quite as colorful a character to play here as she did, say, in Fargo Season 2. You know, she's not maybe quite as interesting as that character was. But she's making the most of what she's got, so you can see that she's hurt by this. And that's why I think she just leaves the room, quite frankly. But it's just, it's really sad. But I think it's when she leaves the room, since she comes across that puddle of blood that's dripping up. Yeah. Which, not sure why you do that other than to literalizing the idea of everything's kind of turned upside down here, maybe, or something. But we do find that the blood is from the stabbed body of, you know, the hardly ever fleshed out at all character, Rudy, who is slowly bleeding out from a knife wound in this not completely frozen moment in time.
Yeah, this is one episode where they, you know, they had plenty of, you know, Rudy perspective going on, and it was kind of sad that they didn't, you know, touch on him more in earlier episodes, because I think they really would have, you know, not that this is a bad episode, but I think it would have improved that a little bit more if we knew a little bit more about him.
It would have given those moments just a little bit more weight. We would have felt, we would have felt more sympathy or empathy for the fact he does appear to be dying, for example. But yeah, it's... It was done deliberately. It's how they wrote the damn thing. But it's a curious decision to have been made. I wonder if maybe...
It feels like there's a missing scene, like a missing scene somewhere that they just cut out out of a long episode. And
I'm wondering if that's... I wonder if in an earlier draft of a script or even something that's been shot, we would have gotten more about him and maybe for... Not so much time, because they are clearly, especially because it's on FX, they're allowed to go as long as they want with the show, I think. I think Noah Hawley has some sort of a carte blanche where that's concerned. But maybe they just felt in terms of where it would sit in an episode, that it just didn't jibe well with everything else, pacing-wise or whatever, and they cut it out. But I agree, it's unfortunate, because I think that's a character we were wondering about from Chapter 1, because he's got some amazing abilities. He can flick people away. You know, he's a telekinetic guy to the nth degree, quite frankly. But yeah, it is a shame because it still ends up being like, oh, the character that I almost forget what his name is plays kind of a key part in this episode. I do think this was a great episode of television. But yeah, that if we cared and knew more about Rudy, it probably would have just made those moments just burst even more. Even him being in that spittle thing would have been more.
Yeah.
I think that would have meant more to us if we knew more about him. It would have been like, oh, geez, wow. Whereas we were just like, it didn't even mean. We had to be reminded. Oh, that's that guy. You know.
Yeah, I think you know they're trying hard to do an unconventional superhero show here, and since he's the one with like the most overt power.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just trying to like minimize him to make it seem like the powers are a little bit less important, and they might have went just a little bit too far in that direction and made it so it was harder for us to give a damn.
I agree. In fact, that's one of the things about the show is maybe by them doing just that, striving not to make it about the powers and about making it more like a typical superhero show, sometimes you end up with some questions that we would have been nice to have been answered, but they kind of leave out, which, like, more about Rudy, or the fact that even by the end of this episode, and he's pretty much done for, we never really find out just what the eye is capable of doing. His abilities always will now always remain kind of like, well, he sort of could do this. I guess he's a shapeshifter to some degree, but we've seen him do that. I feel like there's more to him than just that, but we never really, I don't think we ever find out for sure. I mean, does it matter based on what happened in this episode? I guess not, but it would have been nice to have gotten a little bit more about him. Although he did get a nice showcase in this whole clockwork scenario. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and there's a chance we'll see him before, or see him, you know, more of him at some point. I mean, bringing back his partner at the end of the episode, I mean, they might be telegraphing that maybe there's some way we'll see him again. But who knows?
I don't know. After what
he's happened, he's a little fucked up.
A little. Yeah, kind of like Sonny Corleone was a little fucked up in The Godfather. It's probably one of the most graphic ways to get rid of a character that I've ever seen, quite frankly. I mean, that was something right out of like an episode of Hannibal, almost. Also, back at Clockwork, Sid does find Rudy and Carrie and gets those magic glasses on him. It was interesting, because she keeps continuing to look for Melanie and David. Those are the two names she keeps saying over and over. You know, Melanie, David. Did it seem odd that she never says Tanami's name? Because he's there too. Why does she never look for the other one of them? That seemed really strange to me. Especially because he had a really good part in the previous episode where we were talking about his mother's death and the dream and, you know, even the thing I was talking about earlier with the Everybody Loves Dogs thing. And it's like they kind of forgot about him in this episode. It's kind of a strange decision, but okay.
Yeah, maybe she, like, you know, noted that he was, like, just thoroughly, like, locked into whatever, like, memory he was trapped in. They just didn't think they'd be able to break him out of it. While all the other characters seemed to be, like, trying to figure out what was going on, he seemed content just to, like, you know, stay in that, like, you know, mom getting killed by a dishwasher or whatever the hell was going on there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it didn't take away from the episode, and maybe that would have just made it a bit too busy in one of the most memorable sequences I've seen on any TV show ever that we're going to get to shortly. So it was just something I wondered about. If we were grading this episode the way we grade TV shows on another podcast, I wouldn't be deducting any points for that. It was just kind of like a kind of a thing to me. But let's get to, like, what's one of the unexpected joys of the episode. When we get to David and he's trapped in that mental coffin, as he puts it. The fact that he's talking to himself and then he's really talking to himself, but his other self, the rational self, is speaking with a British accent, which is Dan Stevens' actual accent. So, you know, it's like he's chatting up with Matthew Crawley, his Downton Abbey character or something. And I love that the joke is they even make note, like, but I have a British accent. Like, yes, because I love how being rational equals having a British accent.
Oh yeah, they're making fun of so much stuff in this, like, just little thing here, and, you know, it doesn't, you know, has nothing to do with the story that's going, and they're just doing it just to be funny, and it's definitely working.
Yeah, when I was talking about the show the other day, it was with that same conversation I referred to earlier. We talked about the fact that they're doesn't feel like there's that much humor on the show, or there, which I kind of disagree with to a certain degree. I mean, I think one of my favorite scenes on the show is still the conversation on the pier. Is all about the humor. Oliver's character has there's a lot of humor going on with that character, quite frankly. But I think it's because there's so much dark and disturbing imagery and moments on the show, you almost forget about that. It's more darkly comic or sardonic at times. But this was just in the middle of stuff that could be so dark and so weird, this was genuinely funny, and, you know, and totally unexpected. I did not see this coming. Totally unexpected, which is what we say about the show quite often, I think. Now, within that mental coffin, I think what's great here is that there's that realization that sets in that everything, it's just an idea, an illusion. So David can essentially imagine himself out of the trap. And he creates that whole classroom scenario, I guess, which complete with blackboards that eventually animate the backstory of David's parentage and his subsequent bonding with that Shadow King. There is enough to talk about there that I'm gonna put that on the shelf for later, just so I can just whip through the rest of the stuff. There's a few things that I don't really want to get into a recap of. I think I just want to talk about them, but I'm gonna push it to the side for the moment. But what I was saying before, the point of the scene, it's not only for exposition, but I think it's to help give the viewers clarity so that we have a stronger foothold on just what's happening here. Because this is a series that, as we talk about it, can really be almost dizzying. And I think they really do a great job of giving us some sense of structure while not giving everything away at the same time. Now, elsewhere, you know, even though those huge eyes keep reappearing everywhere, which I guess really kind of shows how the Shadow King is very, what's the word? Is it omnipresent? Is that how the word is
pronounced? Yeah, omnipresent, yeah.
Which I guess that's almost a godlike quality, which now that I'm thinking about it, didn't Lenny say the only important thing in the previous episode is God or the only important creature is God or something?
Yeah, something like that.
So you get this sequence, which talk about something that I won't even try to recap, because it would no amount of recapping will ever do it the justice it deserves. And you know the thing I'm talking, it's the thing that starts with Oliver, he starts, I guess you could say he's conducting all these hundreds of letters and that are floating around in midair. Oh, by the way, I took a look at them. I'm pretty sure all those letters, although they're all repeated, I think they're all the letters that form the word shield. And they're just all floating around. Because I think what he's doing is actually, he's trying to create a shield between the bullets and Sid and David. But it's one of those things, like, you might not realize that's what he's doing unless you, like, you pause and you want, or you put it on slow. It's like, oh, there's an S, there's an L, there's an I, there's an E. I mean, I might be wrong. We'll wait to see if there's any writers out there who catch on to that or not. But I think that's what was happening. But beyond that, you know what? I don't think there's a good way to describe what happens over the next 6 or 7 minutes of this episode. All I'm going to say right now is that if we thought they were being adventurous back in Chapter 5, when they did that little sequence where there was the lack of sound that happened, you thought there was something wrong with your TV for probably a few minutes. This is, talk about movie homages. This is a straight up silent movie kind of homage. Even going as far as having, you know, dialogue title cards pop up and Lenny suddenly looks like she's some demonic Charlie Chaplin on acid or something. There's so much. I'm putting that on the shelf with the other thing. I think those are going to be the two big things I want to, let's go back and forth with you about. And even if we're just going to be like gushing about it or like, what the fuck? But I'll say at the end of that extended, wonderful sequence, David's broken free. Rudy, what we were talking about before, of all people, kind of sort of saves the day, at least for the moment. And David manages to catch those bullets like he's a Kryptonian or something, quite frankly. So as we rush to the closing of this episode, you know, they're back at Summerland. Oliver is now there with them. But sadly, it still seems like he doesn't quite remember his wife, so there's it all feels kind of bittersweet, I think. And now Amy is there. She's as apologetic as ever. But we see that David's starting to get plagued by visions of things like that world's angriest boy popping up yet again, even while he's wearing the halo. So Loudermilk, who is experiencing some serious issues with his own sister, because she feels he abandoned her at the hospital, he's insisting they get David over to his lab, which apparently is on the other side of this complex, I guess to deal with the Shadow King once and for all or what have you. But en route, they are surrounded by dozens of Division 3 soldiers. And that the partner you were talking about, he's only listed as the Interrogator from Chapter 1. Although now his face looks like he's like a modern day version of the Hound from Game of Thrones or something, because it looks like it's got part of his face got melted off. It ends at him, he just wants David to kill the rest. But all of a sudden, as we dive deep inside the recesses of David's mind, we see that Lenny, or the Shadow King, is now in that mental coffin, but he's starting to break out right about now. So that's your episode. I know I left out some details, but they were details that happened in sequence I wanted to talk about just in our regular conversation here. Let's just get the opinions out here. I mean, we've been pretty high on every episode. I was a little less high on last week, but I still thought it was, you know, I still thought it was an A episode, just not an A plus. Putting this up alongside the previous six, what was your real gut reaction to this one? I mean, how did this make you feel?
I think, well, I was, well, as soon as I got done watching the episode, I messaged our friend CJ and told him that I thought this was the best of the season so far, which he, you know, told me that I tell him the same thing every week, but I definitely, you know, it's holding up in the 12 hours or so since I watched it, that it definitely, you know, just seems to be the best between, like, the, you know, the fun stylistic choices that they keep making, and just the way that we got, you know, actual information, took time to talk about like actual like information and try to brainstorm, and then like an ending that made me just like, fuck, I wish the next episode was just like right after that so I could watch it. This doesn't always happen,
right? Well, we've talked about other shows over the years where quite often the penultimate episode may often be even better than the final episode. I mean, it used to be the case with Game of Thrones. We've seen it happen with Mad Men and other shows, or shows that are like that. Not necessarily the last episode, but one leading up to it is the wow episode. I mean, even not like, you can even go back to Ozymandias and Breaking Bad. I know that wasn't the penultimate one. It was there was two after that, but it kind of felt like it was the penultimate one, because the last two could have been like one big episode. I kind of agree. I think a case could be made that this might be the best episode of the series, although, you know, one might still want to put the pilot aside, I guess, because it did the best balancing act that we've seen so far of everything, of being entertaining and being scary and being funny and giving us a lot of information without it feeling like it's just someone yapping at us, you know, because even the greatest things of all time can have that feeling. I mean, you can watch a movie like Psycho, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, but, you know, an issue with Psycho is you're stuck with a giant expositional dump at the end of the movie, which is kind of follows the suit with a lot of mysteries. A lot of mystery novels and then movies kind of have that ending where everything has to be explained, and it's the nature of how those stories are told, but it still becomes, someone's just going to tell me everything at the end of this. This episode weaves that throughout the episode, but it never feels like, oh, okay, let me sit down and take notes here. Although, oddly enough, I am taking notes, but, you know. But the fact that they can deliver answers while still being really artistically impressive and really memorable, I mean, look, two of us and plus most of our listeners probably have watched lots and lots of upper tier, as we call them, TV shows over the years. You know, everything we've already mentioned, your Game of Thrones, Leftovers, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Fargo, whatever. What I'm going to say about this show is that those shows, generally speaking, with the occasional exception, we usually tend to focus on like moments or scenes that were like really mind-boggling. I don't know how many of those shows, and as great as they are, have not just had sustained scenes or sequences, but even overall episodes that were just, quite frankly, as awe-inspiring as this has been, with so much creative bravado. I mean, they take chances, and they have such balls with this show. I mean, what Noah Hawley has done is more, to me, it's actually more impressive what he's been doing with this than what he did with the first two seasons of Fargo, outside of the idea of even doing a Fargo TV show at all, which was probably the ballsiest thing, quite frankly.
Yeah, they're being really audacious with what they're doing, and I haven't seen Deadpool yet. From what I've heard, it kind of seems like Deadpool, you know, did similar things, you know, in the movie aspect, where they just, you know, just went balls to the wall, did whatever crazy shit they wanted to do, and it managed to work. So I think that might be kind of what they're doing here, and it's definitely working for some of us who enjoy this kind of, you know, odd, abstract TV show.
Yeah, it's not conventional. I mean, and Deadpool, just to be quick about that, I mean, what makes Deadpool interesting is the basic story of Deadpool is about as formulaic as you get. It's a very formula story. But they just go about it in a very audacious, entertaining way, breaking, smashing, and shattering the fourth wall throughout the film, so it ends up standing out from any other quote-unquote superhero movie that's been out, or probably will ever come out, quite frankly. And that's what makes Deadpool work so well, where I can recommend it to someone who doesn't care a thing about superhero movies, and they'll be vastly entertained by it because it's so different. So So yeah, it's kind of like that kind of a thing where, okay, they're just doing something different than what they've done on first any other superhero show, that's for sure, whether it be DC or Marvel. And I love that you don't got to be a Netflix show to do something as crazy as this. That I think this is more interesting than any of the Netflix shows, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And forget, and the DC shows look like they're preschool compared to this. It's like
Yeah.
it's like I don't they're not it's not the same class. I mean, I may love them, on the occasional episode, but we're talking, it's not even apples, it's apples and aardvarks. It's that difference as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and they're doing stuff that's really, audacious and cool, but I get the impression they're just like they're more focused with telling a good story and using all these weird decades and decades of cinema and TV and having all these different storytelling like avenues that they can take, and they're just using those where they're just using it to like tell a cool story. They're not trying to like make themselves look cool, so like people just be like, invite them to parties or whatever. It just seemed like, I just don't get the impression that there's a lot of conceit behind this.
No, I just this show. I would love to be a fly on the wall in the writer's room, and because you've got the writing of it, but then one wonders because one. I mean, having looked at what a script, a regular script or a shooting script, so much of this is about just really fascinating or interesting visuals, and these are things that a writer might not necessarily be able to conceptualize. It's someone has to take it beyond that, the people behind the show, the directors, the cinematographers, the editors, whatever. And so much of the show is done with practical effects as opposed to saturating us with CGI or something. I mean, I'm sure there is CGI on this show, but they do it in a way where you're not as aware of it as you are with other shows over the years. So there is a line in the episode which I think was significant. That refers to the Shadow King as being disguised as Lenny, but isn't her. And I want to just point that out because I feel that's really the first super duper on the nose acknowledgement, maybe since the first half of chapter one, that yes, Lenny was a real person, and now that's just another, I guess, mask you could say that the Shadow King has been using.
Right.
Because I think there's been some question about that, even though we kept saying, but Sid sees Lenny back then, but one might be wondering, whoa, but is Lenny already the show? It's like, no, that's not what happened. Lenny was Lenny. Lenny died. Shadow King took Lenny's face. It's pretty much what I think. So I love that this kind of, that's one of those things that kind of, I feel this episode kind of put that to rest, at least as far as I'm concerned. Question. I have, by the way, some of the questions I have, we might not have any answers for. I don't know. But since you keep coming up with cool shit, maybe you'll have some. So, all that chaotic anarchy that we see that's happening in the halls of Clockworks, did you think that in some way that it's all these people who seem to be going insane, they're almost zombified, quite frankly, at times. Did you think that this is some sort of manifestation of the voices that are in David's head? And maybe these are
Yeah.
representative of like the multiple personalities that he's supposed to made absorbed if you go by like the comic book origins of his character.
Yeah, kind of like, maybe like, takes all of David's concentration to like keep all those like voices, that are already screaming at him to like, just to keep them at bay. And then when a Shadow King's in the reins, he just doesn't care if it's just a complete clusterfuck. So they just, just run around doing whatever the heck they want.
Right, because the Shadow King would revel in it. I know I didn't pronounce that correctly. You know what I mean? Revel. The Shadow King would revel in the chaos of this. Of course he would. It would. He would. She would. Whatever. Speaking of things, so here's something I don't think we're going to have an answer for. Maybe you do. Don't know. Kind of curious. So, just what is it Melanie is whispering in Rudy's ear? Because they show that a couple times, so she's talking in his ear for quite some time, but we don't have an indication of what it is she's saying to him. So I'm curious about that, especially because it's a character that we haven't really gotten much story about. So why is Melanie whispering so much into his ear? It doesn't look like she's consoling him or telling him he's going to be okay, especially because when she's doing that, it's when he's still in that sort of kind of frozen in time thing. So that was a very strange thing. I wonder if we're going to get an answer to that or not.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with that, but I'm guessing that they probably aren't going to leave it hanging. And
yeah, because otherwise,
we'll
why
see.
do it? Why do it? It doesn't make any sense. They went to the trouble of showing us that they are trying to save him, that they're he's brought back to Summerland on a stretcher or whatever. Wasn't really sure why David wouldn't just, since he seems to be able to have this transporting ability, why he couldn't transport them there as opposed to, well, so transport you to the forest, but we're just going to walk the rest of the way. So let's go back to those things that I didn't really want to blather about in the recap, because I thought it would be more fun to talk about it now. Let's talk a little bit about that animated backstory that we got for David. The one that I love, that it starts with stick figures and then it gets progressively, the animation, the style gets more sophisticated as it goes along. I think that they, unlike any other episode, they just went as far as they probably could to clarify David's past and present more than I think that we've ever gotten before. So here's where we get into the whole theory about his parentage. Now, again, I still love your theory. I think it would work so nicely and come, you know, bring certain things together for the show, whatever. But I gotta say, with what they do with the animation, they're pretty much, they're ringing the bell that David's dad is who his dad is in the comics after all, because they go through a lot of not so subtle trouble here, you know, because they depict his father in the animation as, you know, he's bald, he's got these psychic mental abilities. I believe we see an X somewhere in there at one point. I'm pretty sure that ain't Lex Luthor, because it's the wrong comic book company. I'm pretty certain that they are going to be going with it being, they're not going to change the Professor X thing, that they are going to have it be that Professor X is indeed his dad. And then it just makes me curious if they will in any way have anything like that show up in the series. I doubt it'll happen this season, but I wonder if in season two that might happen. Because, you know, I think I read somewhere that Patrick Stewart would love to make an appearance on this show, which... We love Patrick Stewart. That would be the one connection to those movies I would be okay with. I'd be totally fine, even if they did something, if they had the money to do like what they did in Rogue One, and they gave us like a younger Patrick Stewart or something, like they smoothed out the lines in his face, like Michael Douglas in Ant-Man or something. I would be fine with that. That could be their one real link to the movies. But nothing else.
That would be cool. I just envision him sitting back watching the show and just be like, okay, you know, he calls his agent and he's like, this is nothing like season one of Next Generation. You know, make it so. I want to be on this.
Yeah, quite the opposite, quite frankly. Oh, by the way, going back to something you were saying just about how much we liked this episode, I think another reason, I think what made this such a superior episode in a season that's already had excellent episodes, is David is finally a stronger character again. Because he's been kind of victimized, he's been kind of passive the last couple episodes. This is an episode where, you know, while you could still have Sid being a strong character and being a driving force, David is finally a stronger character again. And he's really starting to take control of things. And I think just as a viewer, as a person, we kind of relate to it because we all want to be able to take control in our own lives. So we instantly want to root for that character. And I think they do a better job with David in this episode than we had for the last few, where it's like, oh, I don't understand what's happening to me. And oh, I'm a prisoner here. I'm a captive there. Or I'm, you know, that this thing is bothering me here. I think here he's leading the charge, so to speak. He's escaping. He's literally, and I know I keep using that word, I don't apologize, but he's relying on himself, although with a British accent, but he's relying on. So that's another reason I would agree that this, there's a really great case to be made for this being the best episode of the series so far.
Yeah. Right.
The best case is what we're going to talk about now. That amazing several minutes, and I think I ticked it off on the counter on the DVR. It's roughly between 6 and 7 minutes with no spoken dialogue. But we get So much story, so many memorable visuals. It was like a, I don't know, like a virtual Christmas morning of wonderfulness here. More than anything else in this episode, I think that was like the wow of the episode, where you just stare at it and you kind of want to go back and rewatch it all over again just to see how they pulled off what they did there.
You know, it's been a really interesting, compelling show, like from pretty much nonstop from the beginning. But I don't know if it's had a lot of moments where you just sit back and like the last few minutes of the Breaking Bad episode, 1 minute, or just a variety of other shows where you're just watching something and you're just like, holy shit, like the last 5-10 minutes of my life just disappeared, and I was like, there was nothing else that existed for that moment. And I think they managed to capture that kind of feeling there for me, anyway.
Yeah. Thank you. And again, what makes this episode so significant is in that sequence, and it's all these things, it's beyond a sequence because you have multiple things going on, multiple storylines going on all together. The fact that you can have it be, parts of it or elements of it are action and story, but there's also a lot of humor. It's very dark humor, but just having silent movie dialogue cards pop up is so, you use the word audacious. We've used the word audacious a bunch of times. That's beyond audacious. that's a risk because we could have totally just fallen out of it at that point. Because then we wouldn't be taking, you couldn't take it seriously. But I credit not just the visuals, but, and we've said it practically every podcast, Aubrey Plaza's performance is significantly something that I think becomes more impressive from episode to episode. If she doesn't get an award nomination for this next year or later this year, that's a crime. Because, yeah. I've said it online and in our podcast, I keep being amazed and shocked by how good she is, which isn't to say that I don't think she was a talented actress, whatever, before, but what she does here, holy crap! I thought her musical thing, dancing routine in the previous episode was something. Forget that! When she's gonna kill Sid and Carrie and the whole crooking her neck thing and oh my gosh.
Well, they just don't train actors to do the stuff that like Chaplin or Buster Keaton or whoever did way, way, way back in the day anymore. But to see somebody that just like isn't very old, has done for the most part, pretty conventional roles, just completely own something like that, without the benefit of any dialogue that the character is, saying visually, it's just amazing.
Yeah, it's there's so much going on in this. Oh, by the way, since I know I tend to focus like on Sid being my favorite on the show because I love her. But I gotta say, as far as other characters, obviously the whole Lenny Aubrey Plaza thing is right up there as far as one of my favorites just to watch. And I love Oliver. I think the Oliver character is just, I love that actor. I know he's from Flight of the Conchords, which I've never actually watched. Seeing him on this makes me want to check that out, or at least give it a shot. I bet I still won't like it, but I just absolutely got such a huge kick out of him in this episode because he's entertaining, and I love that he keeps mixing in whenever he's basically delivering exposition, but then he keeps sidetracking himself. He's suddenly talking about barbershop quartets, or he's talking about, some sort of drink or food or whatever. He's just or beat poetry again or something. If there was a character who looked like he could be very easily be plopped into the Twin Peaks world, I think that would be the character. Oliver seems like he's straight out of Twin Peaks as far as I'm concerned.
Plus, he'd be a good podcaster with all the tangents that he keeps going on.
Yeah, and he's actually well spoken, so he'd actually be better. Yeah. Certainly be better than me. Oh, and lastly, just in that whole great sequence, and I know other than hinting at it, we didn't really talk about that much. And again, I apologize for that phone you're hearing in the background, but I can't do anything about it.
maybe it's Oliver trying to get a hold of you.
Yeah, from the great way he's not dead. Also, you gotta love how we got one villain removing another. Because And I love that it just shows that how, you know, the godlike status or devil-like status, whatever you want to call it, of Lenny is like just the way she kind of disposes of the eye. It's like, yeah, I've got no more use for you. I'll take care of it. I'll take it from here. And it's like the eye is an idea she had. Like if you wrote some, like you had written something, it's like, yeah, enough of this, and you crumple it up and throw it away. Because with her abilities, she crumples up the eye. And it's this, that, oh, by the way, CGI. There's your CGI. So yeah, there's a CGI effect. In case anyone's like, wait, they did do CGI. Yes, I know. But it was such a twisted, bizarre thing of like basically crumpling up the eye and reducing him to this, you know, pulverized, bloody package. And then when we end up in the room with the gunfire going off, the fact that I don't want to say literal because I've used it like 20,000 times in this podcast. But he has a genuine meltdown. Let's put it that way. He just, it's like something out of the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Except he just becomes this ball of bloody pulpy flesh, I guess.
Yeah, and it was cool too because, I mean, just, you know, Lenny is pretty much just like, you know, dismissing the character, like, we don't need you anymore. And then the show itself is kind of doing that. I mean, like, though they're still showing what's going on to him, but it's just kind of like, you know, off in the corner sometimes. They're not fixating on it at all and just like, you know, like, hey, look at this, like, crazy special effect and, like, you know, ignore, like, look at the awesome, like, zombie makeup and ignore how shitty our plot is. It isn't, like, anything like that. They're just kind of, like, doing it off in the corner and just, like, you know, some characters are kind of, like, looking at it disgusted and then they just get back to what's going on. I thought it was really funny the way they just kind of like, you know, just kind of discard the character like that and almost, you know, in a way that makes him kind of insignificant.
Yeah, I agree. Because it always seemed like he was at best, he was like, a glorified henchman. Because he was never the main guy at Division 3. He was always seemed to be, he was working with or for other people. And he kind of took center stage here, but it was never really going to be about him. So I like that they just kind of like, okay, we've done enough with you. That's enough. There's only one other thing I wanted to ask about, and then we can probably move towards our wrap-up here. At the end, when Amy is talking to David, it's right at the beginning of their conversation, when she says to him that she should have told him about the man. And he asks her about that, but then all of a sudden their conversation gets sidetracked with her wanting to call home, her husband, yada, 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 and they never get back to it. Who do you think she's talking about?
I'm not sure.
It's very deliberate the way it's phrased, because he even asks about it, and then they get sidetracked. So it's done for a reason, and I'm curious about it, because my initial instinct was, oh, maybe it's referencing his father, but I keep thinking, well, probably the only time she ever would have seen his father was when David was brought to him as a baby, and I think she said that she was like 4 years old or something. So I was thinking, I don't think she could be referring to a memory of her when she was four, but who knows? It's possible. Or is it someone else? I don't think it would be like a Division 3 thing, because it sounds like it's a long-held secret. So I'm wondering if it's about his father. It seems to be the most likely explanation. So, okay. I have one
small thing. I kind of thought that it seemed kind of funny, but the way that they were using the like the diving costume, it kind of seemed like they were using it in like the way the, like, Magneto's helmet functions to like keep out like Professor X's like mental abilities. It kind of seemed like they were using the, you know, the big Jules Verne costume, like that, just like it had the ability to, like, you know, keep out the Shadow King. So I thought it was just kind of a neat way to do that.
Yeah, and I love the fact that Oliver actually refers to the diving outfit as Jules Verne.
Yeah.
which is nice, because then we had, I was thinking back to a previous episode, I think it was the one where we never get to hear what Carrie had been dreaming about. And I think I even theorized, well, she's the one who has never really, quote-unquote, slept before, so maybe she wouldn't be experiencing dreams. But then I forgot, so I'm actually correcting something I said in a previous podcast, that she starts to make a reference to, have you ever seen 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Which is a the Jules Verne novel, which is where then we get the diving outfit, which is from, you know, I guess Jules Verne, or the idea of it is, I guess, whatever. So I like how those kind of things just came together in my mind, like just now.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to watching the entire season at some point. You know, I'll just, you know, binge it, or I guess me, it'll take like 2 months to binge it. But it'd be interesting to watch the whole thing, like after knowing how it ends, and just see all the stuff that they've had, you know, how much of a blueprint they've had laid out. Because I get the feeling that they, you know, they definitely did a really extensive job of like filling in stuff, you know, beforehand and making it really, you know, just there's probably all sorts of stuff in there that we, you know, even when you've been rewatching it that you haven't seen yet, that, you know, you can't apply because you haven't seen three episodes later or whatever. I'm just looking forward to seeing that kind of thing.
I agree. I think there will be a lot of that with this series, but unlike other series and even shows that I like or have defended, they do a better job with this because it's not like, oh, in order to appreciate this, you have to have understood what happened in this previous episode, which we're only explaining now. That's not the best storytelling when shows have done that. I mean, I usually give them a break. I know which ones. I don't want to go in for another several minutes here. You know, certain comedy series that returned on Netflix were very guilty of this, among others. But yeah, it also makes for a great binge because it's only 8 episodes. So
yeah,
so it's got that going for it as well. All right, so I guess we can close the book on chapter 7 of Legion, as well as start to wrap up our podcast here. I do, just for the heck of it, just thought I'd mention, because I feel like a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are probably awaiting, I guess is the correct word, what we're going to be doing in April, because not one, but two of the other TV series that we happen to love podcasting about both come back pretty much at the same time or within a week of each other. Better Call Saul and Fargo, which we were on one hand delighted about, because yay, both of our favorite shows are coming back, and wait, they're both coming back at the same time? What? Oh, damn you. So I think what we're most likely going to do, we were discussing it before recording this morning, at least after the first episode of Better Call Saul, which comes back on the 10th, but from that point on, since both that and Fargo will be on, you know, on a weekly basis, you know, within a couple of days of each other, we're probably going to merge those into one podcast. I think whether we actually officially call it Better Call Fargo, or we don't really title our podcast beyond, you know, Serious TV Drama Chronicles episode 175 or whatever heck we'll be up to at that point. But I think that's what we're going to do. Hopefully, maybe that'll keep us on track to being somewhat concise with a. Maybe I won't go recap crazy with them as I sometimes have in the past. I don't know. But I think that's what's going to have to be done just for our own sanity. So that way we can keep doing that as well as a superhero one, as well as have normal lives during the course of the week.
Yeah. And I'm sure there might be some weeks where we end up having to split them up just because, you know, we have something. One of us has something going on in the weekend and we have to do something funky. But, you know, we'll definitely work hard to get everything out in a timely fashion for those who want to hear what us two chowder heads have to say about these high-quality television series.
Yeah, I mean, after that first episode, I mean, it's unlikely we'll be doing things where they'll be released, like, you know, with the same night or anything like that. I don't think we're probably not going to be doing that too much. But we'll whatever we end up doing, whether it's a combo podcast or whether we do ever have to separate them due to time constraints or whatever else is going on, we'll at the very least endeavor to get the podcast out within the same week's time of an episode, you know. So we'll try. You know, again, we're not getting paid for this, so, you know, wah wah. Okay. So let's wrap up so we can you can get to work and I can get another cup of coffee. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you will undoubtedly enjoy our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and then join the conversation about this show as well as many others. You can find us on iTunes, pretty much the same way, only you go to iTunes. You type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. It would be really nice for us to start getting more ratings and reviews there because that's what my life is all about, getting ratings and reviews. Or birthday wishes on my Facebook page, because that's how I keep track of things. I keep score, because I'm that sad. Then finally, you can also follow us on Twitter, What the heck is our... Oh, yeah, it's at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. And that's about it for this morning. I'll be speaking to you later this evening yet again. And...
yeah, hopefully you enjoy your birthday in between now and when you get to, you know, really finish the day in a good way by talking to me again.
Yeah,
maybe go get yourself a slice of pizza or some, you know, insect-laden cherry pie. That'd be a good thing to do.
Pizza's really the only kind of pie I ever actually eat other than, wait, not going to go there. Unfortunately, I still got a lot of notes to write for that damn podcast later tonight. So, yay, my birthday is going to be writing recaps of Legends of Tomorrow and Arrow. Yay. Anyway, so that's it for this podcast. So thanks for getting together with me to do it this morning. And thanks to everyone listening out there. And good, still morning. So good morning, everybody.
Happy birthday, everybody. Especially you, Scott.